I wanted to start out today a little differently than I normally would start out an interview. And I want to ask this question this way. Can you paint for me a picture of what life was like for you growing up in the Jim Crow South in the state of Arkansas?
Well, first of all, I am from Arkansas, Magnolia, Arkansas. My hometown was 9,999. The day I was born, I made it 10,000. But during that time, I didn't know if things could have been better. I thought that was the way things were. The racial part of it, I didn't encounter that much because we knew we stayed on one side of town and the other people stayed on the other side of town. So it was never coming together of anything. So when I left home to go play baseball, that was when I encountered all of the racism that I had never known to be.
Interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about what were your parents' occupations? What did they do for a living?
Well, my mother was she was a my daddy did he worked.
Okay.
And mother, when we were smaller, mother was home raising us. As we got a little older, my mother started working. She worked and that during that time, the only work that they could get was house cleaning, babysitting, and cooking. And my mama had job babysitting. She raised a lot of people kids because she was a good babysitter. She cooked and she did other things too, but that was mainly her occupation was babysitting and cooking. My daddy, he had several jobs as I was growing up. I remember log cutting was a great thing for black men back in those days. My daddy was a log cutter, and then he went into gardening. He worked for the city cemetery. He was a gardener for the cemetery, cut the grass and kept the things up around there before he went into his own little business of cutting grass around the city. Had his own garden business. But that was it, more or less. I remember my daddy, he did a lot of hunting. And he would hunt for fur, minks, coon, foxes. And I, as a young man, I would mail them off to Sears Roebuck. That's where he sold them to Sears Roebuck. And as I reminisce back, I remember the smile on my daddy's face when he would get a check for $25, $15, $20. From Sears Roebuck, for the furs that he had sent in. And I sent in. I was the mailer. I was the one that sent them off.
Fascinating. Your parents both sound like lovely people. I wanted to now turn our attention to baseball, and I wanted to ask you simply, how did you come to fall in love with the game of baseball?
Well, I guess I'm a what you would call a homegrown athlete. I've always loved baseball, even though we didn't have a baseball. I would listen to my grandmother had a radio that the people had given her, and I used to listen to old baseball games on the radio. And I dreamed of being a baseball player. As a little boy, we didn't have a baseball. I took a sock. I made a baseball out of a sock. That's what we played with, a sock and somebody cut down a little tree or something, made a bat until somebody got one of their grandmother's broomsticks for the bat. But that's how it got started. We call it stick ball. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon somebody got a tennis ball and we started playing, had a tennis ball, but no baseball. And for a lot of years, we played stick ball. I remember one day they took up a collection in class for a softball, mm-hmm. to buy a softball. And but then one day word had came out that Jackie Robinson had opened the door. Mm-hmm. And that was the sign for me right there, because I knew there were no blacks playing in the major leagues. And when I heard about Jackie, that was a sign to me that now I got a chance. So I excelled in baseball. The school where I went to, we didn't have a baseball team at first. Mm-hmm. All of our books, everything we had came down from the high school. And I remember one day seeing a baseball and a bat and gloves in a box that came from the school. The rest of the kids didn't pay any attention to it, but a guy by the name of Bo Dunn and myself, he grabbed the glove, I grabbed the ball and the glove, and we started throwing the ball to each other, and that progressed on to a lot of other guys playing, you know, throwing the ball, and finally the school decided they have a baseball team. And most of the black schools during that time baseball was not a major sport, even in the black colleges. So I was pretty good in baseball. I developed a pitch. I call it a drop. That's what we call a drop back in those days. Now they call them sinkers. But I'm getting a little older now, and I could throw that pretty good. So we played a lot of the other schools, and I pitched, and I would win every time because they couldn't hit my drop.
Huh.
And as I got older, the city team offered me 75 cents if I would pitch the game for them.
Uh-huh.
I'm 15 years old now.
Yeah.
And they're going to give me 75 cents. That was a lot of money in my day for me. So I accepted the pitch. And that was the day Sunday I was supposed to be at church. And I went to make that 75 cent, and my daddy came and got me off the diamond. One of the most embarrassing days of my life. And he got me and took me back to church. I did not get my 75 cent that day, but the next Sunday, the team was playing in Spring Hill, Louisiana. And I did go. And I pitched the game. I got my 75 cent. Of course, we lost the game, but I got my 75 cents for playing. And from that day on, my daddy never said anything to me about me playing ball. I grew up in a religious family, Church of God in Christ. Playing ball was a sin, supposedly. But I didn't believe that. Neither did my brothers. But that was something that my mom and daddy strived on. It was a sin to play a game. So my older brother said, "Brother, it's no sin to play ball." From that day on, I played ball, and mom and dad never protest against it anymore after that.
Fascinating. And you had mentioned Jackie, and I want to get to Jackie later on in the conversation. But right now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about these stickball games. Did you play any other positions aside from pitcher? And if so, which one was your favorite?
I played all positions. I played wherever they needed someone. I pitched mostly. I was a pitcher.
Okay.
And I lettered in baseball in high school. I lettered in football and basketball. I was all around athlete and track also. But baseball was something that it was my favorite, I should say.
Yes.
And I put everything I had into it. Bo Don and I would throw every day. Every day we were throwing to each other. He was a catcher. I was a pitcher. Mm-hmm. And I developed a drop, good fastball. I didn't know what I throw the ball. I got large hands, so the ball would do different things. And then I discovered some of the older players in the team were showing me how to throw the curveball and how to throw the fastball. And I developed as a pretty good pitcher. The black schools had a tournament in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, the black schools baseball. And I pitched no hitter. And a guy from the Chicago American Giants, a scout or somebody saw me. I don't know if he was a scout or what, but he asked me how I'd like to play with the Chicago American Giants. I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, you're going to get paid. Well, the word getting paid meant a lot to me because I had already visited Gremlin College for football. They offered me a scholarship in football. Arkansas A.M. and N., which is now the University of Arkansas, offered me a scholarship in basketball. But no one offered me a scholarship in baseball. And I was about to take the scholarship to play football when I got the call asking me how would I like to play with the Chicago American Giants. And I was going to get paid and be in Chicago Tuesday morning, Washington Park, Diamond number 3. So that was my start right there.
So, and you talk at length about this in your book, but I wanted to ask you. So you go to Chicago, to Washington Park, to Diamond number 3, and you meet a fella named Mr. Washington. Could you talk to me about how you met Mr. Washington? Could you talk about your relationship with him and why it was that he was such an important figure in your life?
Well, I met him the first day in Chicago, and I often said this, the Lord put him in my life. I was only 17 years old. I knew no one in Chicago. Here I am, little country boy going to the big city to try out, play baseball. And I got, you know, in my book, I tell about how I got to Washington Park and how I was walking down, a bus driver showed me Washington Park, and I was walking down the street, and I saw the sun parlor on 51st and South Parkway. 51st and Champlain. And I saw this gentleman sitting in the sun parlor, standing there. And I just walked up to him because I'm a country boy. I'm used to speaking to people, especially elder people. And I said hello to him, and he spoke to me, and I asked him, I said, I got a tryout in Washington Park. He said, that's Washington Park over there. I said, could I leave my bag with you till I come back? And he said, yeah. And I left my bag with him. My bag had shoes, had a couple of pairs of shoes, and I had some couple of pants and a shirt. But anyway, I took my glove out and spikes out of the bag. I went across the street. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I went across the street, and the first diamond, mm-hmm. baseball diamond I saw was Diamond number 3. And I was early. Mm-hmm. I sat there. Finally, a guy came. One of the players came, and introduced himself to me, and we started throwing to each other. Then another one came, and then a lot of the players came. And the gentleman introduced himself as Mr. Crawford to me, and Frank Crawford. And he said, you know, he had me start throwing the ball, had batters stand up there, and me pitch to him, and I was striking him out with my drop. And even guys that was on the team. And, you know, after the trial, I was going to make the team anyway because I had a contract already filled out, but that didn't mean nothing to me. You know, I'm going to get to the team. I'm going to play on the team. I want to get on the team. So anyway, after he said, we got a room for you on South Parkway, 47 South Parkway. And he said, where's your bag? And I said, it's across the street over there. But when we walked over there, all them buildings looked alike, and I couldn't tell which one I had left my bag with. And, you know, as I walked over there, the young lady came to the Sun Pod and said, are you the young man that left your bag here? And I said, yes. She said, Mr. Watson had to go to work. And he said, you will come back to pick it up. I said, oh, thank you, ma'am. I said, I'm reliving now this life way back 30 years. 60 years ago, really. But anyway, I said, could I have his telephone number? Mm-hmm. He gave me his telephone number. And I took it to this little dinky room they had for me on 47 South Parkway. It was Niles King Drive, but it was South Parkway there. Anyway, I didn't go to sleep all night because people walking and talking. I wasn't used to that. I'm from a little bunch of time where, you know, people go to sleep at 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. Anyway, I couldn't wait until 6 o'clock that morning. I called that number, and he said, where are you? And I looked up, I said, 47 in South Parkway. He said, I'll be right there. And within 10 minutes, he was there. He said, get your bag. I got my bag. Is he going with me? He took me home with him. I met him that day. 28 years later, I buried him. McKinley Washington was his name. He was like a father figure to me. And that's what started me. That was a part of my life I'll never forget.
What a great story. I wanted to now turn our attention. So you try out, you make the team. And I want to ask this. Was there a teammate or teammates on the Giants at the time who really took you under their wing and mentored you? Guys who maybe showed you how things were done in the Negro Leagues at the time?
Yeah, there was a guy they called Superman Pennington. I remember that name. For many years, because he had just come back from the New York Yankees farm team. And he was talking about how they treated him up there. I bet. He said he'd rather come back and play with us. That was another player by the name of Clyde McNeil. And a lot of the players, I don't remember their names anymore. But mm-hmm. The main man that I remember was a guy by the name of James Bell. They called him Cool Papa. He was a coach. He wasn't a player. He was one of the guys that was training us. And we became good friends over the years and over the year and years. And a lot of things that I write about in my book, in my sucking book, came from him. He had been in the league a long time. I did not know of his legacy. All I knew is that he was interested in me because I could run real fast. And right there at Old Comiskey Park, he was training us how to run the bases. And as the years went on, I found out who he really was and what part he played in the Negro Baseball League. But not only him, there was other players that Now I know why they were doing what they were doing. And I'm writing my second book now, and I'm going to talk about it because this is what really happened. These men that fell through the crack when Jackie opened the door never had the opportunity to display those tremendous talents they had in the major league because of the color of their skin. Many of them would have been Hall of Famers. I saw this with my own eyes. I was a part of it, and I can truly state the facts about it. A lot of the history before I was born was passed down to me from them, things that happened in the Negro League that you don't see in no book, and they didn't write about it. So.
I would like to thank you for that answer because I can really feel your passion. But now I wanted to turn our attention to your drop pitch. And I wanted to ask you, who taught it to you? Did you teach it to yourself? Like, how did that pitch come to be?
How did what?
How did the pitch come to be? Did you teach yourself?
Oh, my drop?
Yes, your drop pitch.
I discovered it myself.
Okay.
I call it a drop. I have very large hands. My fingers are on the ball. I could break it off with my wrist. Mm-hmm. And it was 90% of them are balls. But it looks so good coming up to the plate. If a batter got two strikes on him, he's going to swing at it. And it's going to hit the ground. Like I said, 90% of the balls are pitches are balls.
Huh. I now wanted to ask you this. Could you, in your own words, could you recall for me the most memorable game that you were involved in with the Chicago American Giants? And what was it about that game that sticks out in your head all these many decades later, if there is such a game?
Well, there were a lot of them, but one that was always stick out is the one that I got my nickname from. Mm. 1953, Racine, Wisconsin, at a park called O'Hollick Field in Racine, Wisconsin. I was pitching against the Philadelphia Stars. Mm-hmm. There was a pitcher pitching for the Philadelphia Stars, an older guy. And these guys was training up, and they didn't have to be on the same team. If he's on another team and he saw one of us young players doing something wrong, they would correct us. They had missed their calling, but they would have something to look back on by preparing us for the major league. This is something a lot of the historians don't even notice what's happening. These men that fell through the crack was doing this. But anyway, the game I was pitching against a girl, Lefty McGinnis. I'll never forget that name because every inning, he would tell me I'm telegraphing my pitch. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Every end, I'm winning the game now. We winning the game. But yet, he's telling me I'm telegraphing my pitch. Mm-hmm. And I'm striking him out with the drop. And after the game, he came over and, hey, kid, come here. He said, I've been in this league a long time. He said, a batter's trained to watch the ball all the way from the pitcher's hand. So you winding up there two or three times. You're giving the batter a chance to follow the ball all the way to the plate. And I'll never forget what I said to him. You know, I said, they still can't hit it. And they couldn't. But anyway, he showed me, he said, I'm going to show you something. He showed me how not to wind up and how not to cope. Keep the ball covered up until I'm ready to deliver it to the catcher, which will give the batter less time to pick up the pitch. And I didn't use it that day, but I did every day after that. Even today, when I train young pitchers, I show them what he had showed me that day, how to keep a batter, keep the ball as long as he can before the batter can pick it up. That was very important to me. But he was one of the very few men to beat Satchel Paige, and I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. So when I got to the dugout, I wanted a player like Clyde McNeil. Mm-hmm. He said, "Hey, Bill, hey, kid." He called me kid. He said, "You just beat the man." And I didn't know what he was talking about. Satchel Paige was known as the man. He said, "You just beat the man that beat the man." So that became my nickname, the man that beat the man that beat the man.
Fascinating. I now wanted to ask you about something that you talked about in your book a little. Can you tell me more about these barnstorming games against these white teams that your booking agents would book for you guys? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, the booking agent, as I recall back, he was the one made. Come on, we played a lot of, we call the money game, because if we won, we got 60% of the gate. If we lost, we got 40. But these games was played en route to the league game. The league game was played on Friday, Saturday, and a doubleheader on Sunday. The rest of the time, the booking agent was booking not only Chicago American Giants, they were booking for Kansas City Monarch and everybody else. If he knew the route they were going to play the league game, he would book two or three games in between there, and we call them money games. We couldn't afford to lose those games because we needed that money to go to the next city. And that was very important time of the league. Mm-hmm. That was money that they could make to keep going. This is why the league lasted as long as it did.
Did you guys feel at the time that, yes, we're just as good as these white players, and quite often we can beat them? Did you feel that way at the time?
Sir, that's something that resonated often in my mind. Mm-hmm. I would go to a major league game. I would go watch the White Sox play. And I would watch the players on our team, their style and technique of play. It was different. To me,
Dennis. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Your audio is breaking up a little bit. I was wondering if you could just repeat what you were saying.
The players, I would go to watch the White Sox play. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we would go, like Cleveland, we would go and we wouldn't play, because we, Cleveland leaving town, we playing there the next night. And I would watch those games, and like I was saying, a lot of times I was players on Negro League. Mm-hmm. That was just as good or better, but did not get the opportunity to play in the major league. Some of them would have been Hall of Famer and given the opportunity. I saw this, sir. I saw this. I was a part of it. I was there. I'm looking at it. But yet, it was like right now being done about it. I saw these players play and get older and older, and they couldn't play anymore.
Could you, I now wanted to ask you this. Could you tell me who were some of the toughest hitters that you faced in the league?
Sure, that's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I would say a lot of the guys I pitched against, I don't even remember who they were.
Okay.
I remember the game. Like, guys I played against, like Carl Long, it would take me a little time to come up with some name because I the names passed me by.
Uh-huh.
They were not, they were players in the league. I remember some of the things that happened with certain player, Buck O'Neill. I struck him out. I struck him out in Mesa, Arizona. In Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa. We were playing a game that night. He was a coach. This is in 53. And he came in. The game was tied up in the 11th inning. He came in to pinch hit, and I struck him out. I remember that because later on, they said that was Buck O'Neill. And I didn't know him about Buck O'Neill. But, you know, I talked to Buck many years after that. He remember everything that he did, but he doesn't remember that night I struck him out.
Mm-hmm. fascinating. So, obviously, you were very young when you broke in with the Chicago American Giants. You were 17. With that being said, as a 17-year-old kid, was there ever a moment in time where you just said, or you felt like, this is too much, this is too hard, and that you felt like just giving up? Or did you ever have such a moment? Or did you feel like, no, I belong here, I belong with these guys?
I never thought of that. I felt I was just as good as they were, the major leaguers. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have a chance to prove it. Mm-hmm. And but you know, many times I would sit and watch things happen. Watch the money games, especially being called all kind of names. I'd never heard that before in my hometown growing up. I'm 17 years old. They calling us darkers and look at that, you call us negative names. Mm-hmm. And sure, that one time I was, hey, I don't have to take this. But I'll never forget those older guys. And I talk about this all the time because I remember Ted Double the Director, who was the catcher and manager when I played. He got me in my collar one night I think we were in Nashville, Tennessee. He grabbed me in my collar and said, look, boy, if you let that negativism on that field affect your play, you ain't gonna never make it. I knew they was preparing us for the major league. I knew that. All of the young guys on the team knew that we were being prepared because we had a chance and they never did.
Speaking of the majors, I wanted to ask you, so what do guys like Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby mean to you? And moreover, how did you feel when they broke in to the majors with the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Cleveland Indians, respectively?
Well, first of all, I felt I had a chance to break in, too. I was being prepared for that. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
They were pioneers. They were men who, you got to remember, these men, Larry Doby and lotto player played 8-9 years in the Negro League before going to the major league. They a lot of players that would have been in the major league fell through the cracks. You know, Jackie, he didn't open the door. He cracked the door, sir. He cracked the door. It was 9 years before every major league team had a black ball player. And think about all the great black ball players that would have been, that was in their 20s, in their prime of life. But 9 years, they never had a chance because this team had one, this had two. This team didn't have any for 9 years. And a lot of those players fell through the cracks and got too old. And this is what the historians and the writers miss. Mm-hmm. What happened to those players? They became coaches. They became trainers. They prepared the younger players, like Hank Aaron, and Ernie Banks, and Willie Mays. All of us went through that training process that these men fell into. They signed all the younger players up to long binding contracts. And they would sell us to the major leagues if the major league were interested. It became a way of life for them. They would get enough money from the major league for a player to pay the older guy that was training up to keep the league going, sir. That's why the league lasted to 1963. It did not end in 48 or 49 or 50. You show me five books and I'll show you 5 years that they say the league ended. It never ended. It died by the end of 1963.
Mm-hmm. So I now wanted to turn our attention to, and you wrote about this in your book, I want to turn our attention to the incident that happened in spring training while you were with the Chicago Cubs, in which you shattered your ankle. I was hoping two things. Number one, could you recount for me that story? And number two, and maybe more importantly, how did you deal with that adversity?
Well, sir, it was a sad day in my life. The Cubs had purchased my contract. They were purchasing my contract. Spring training, because of my speed, I was given a running activity. Mm-hmm. And I jammed the bag at third base and broke my ankle in two places. Bothers me to this day, but they just said it and prayed, but it never healed. That was a sad day in my life. If I lay there on the ground in Mesa, Arizona, looking up at the sun, knowing that this is my end of my career, thinking it anyway. But you know, as I look back over my life, the Lord did not intend for me to play in the major league. He intended for me to do what I'm doing now, sir, what I've done the last 27 years, making sure that this true history that we call the Negro Baseball League, be passed down to my young people so they will know the true history of a part of history called the Negro Baseball League.
So in a minute here, I want to ask you about your foundation. But before I do that, I want to ask you a question, and I want to ask it this way. Can you just, in your own words, can you tell me what was life like in the Negro Leagues?
Life was different to me than it was to a lot of those older men. And I can say this, because I was being trained, I was learning about life. But those old men who have been denied the opportunity for so many years, it was not life for them. It was life for them, but it was not easy. I was learning about life. I enjoy riding the bus. I was learning about life, but those old men have been doing it 10, 15 years. It was not what they wanted to do, mm-hmm. but they had to do it to survive in the game they called the Negro Baseball League.
Mm-hmm. So now I want to turn to your foundation that you started years after you retired. Yesterday's Negro League Baseball Players Foundation. Two things. What is your mission? And what inspired you to start it?
There was a player named Sherwood Brewer, mm-hmm. who was teammate of Jackie Robinson. Mr. Brewer had been trying for years to get the players that were still living together and have an organization where they could speak for themselves. He started trying to get the players together. And and as he told me one day, it was the most difficult thing for him to ever try to do. Because those players, they did not want to stick together. You know, he had tried so hard getting the group together, but they were, somebody offered them a dollar, they would go there.
Mm-hmm.
So he was having a problem doing this. 1995, years after my baseball career was gone over, I met him. Coors Beer put up $10 million to bring all the living Negro League ball players together.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, sir. And that was a tearjerker. It really was. I walked in that hotel lobby that night, and all I could hear was, there's the kid. That's what they called me when I was playing the kid. And there was something about it. These men, some of them was in wheelchairs, and I just had to, I didn't feel right. Something was wrong here. We had no representation. I hadn't heard of nothing about the Negro League. They were trying to get something together. The older player was trying to get, about five or six of the older players were trying to get them get together. But anyway, make a long story short, after the anniversary, the 75th anniversary of the Negro League, I'll never forget at the airport on my way back home, my wife asked me, what's wrong with you? I said, I don't know, honey. I said, I got to do something. Brewer heard me. And he looked over and said, what's your name? And I told him, I live in Milwaukee. He lived in Chicago. He got my name, address, telephone number. I got his. It was on a Sunday, that Monday morning. I got a call from him. I'm coming to Milwaukee. Pick me up at the bus station. I picked him up at the bus station, and we started talking about what could be done. And from that point on, and we had a lot of help. We had a lot of legal help. We got an organization together. Oh, yes, sir. And the word Negro League, since we found out it belonged to anybody want to use it, we put the word yesterdays there to represent the living player. So yesterday, Negro League represents the living players that played in the Negro Baseball League.
So before we conclude our interview for the day, I wanted to ask you two more questions. First, and you may remember, a couple years ago, Major League Baseball came out and they said that they are formally recognizing the Negro Leagues as major leagues. And as part of that, the Negro League stats would now appear on Baseball Reference along with those of the major leagues. And I wanted to ask you this. As a guy who played Negro League baseball for the Chicago American Giants, how did that make you feel knowing that even back then when you played, you guys thought of yourselves as major leagues, and for all of these decades later, Major League Baseball to finally come out and say, yes, these men were major leaguers. How did that make you feel?
Sir, I felt like I did back in the day when I was playing. Mm-hmm. Looking at these old men, looking at these old living legends and they late years play. They knew they was good or better, but they couldn't do anything about it. I had a chance. My chance was taken away. But I don't know how far I would have gone. All I know is these men, many of them, some of them living today, would have been Hall of Famers had given the opportunity. They didn't have it. So what I'm saying to you is the players that the main league, by them saying Negro League players was as good or better, That's true. That is true. But for them to come up with a way how to benefit them somehow, their families, I don't understand that. I can only say this. We still have players still live today that play, that should be taken care of, that are not being taken care of by the major league. Their name not even, they're not even recognizing the fact that players are still living. That played in the Negro Baseball League. And that hurts me. That hurts me because my name is on that list. And I just wish that the Major League would consider the living players before they even look into the idea of helping some of those players that played 50 years ago. That's all I'm saying about it.
Mm-hmm. So I want to conclude our interview today. I was hoping that you could speak a little more about your relationship with Mr. Brewer.
Okay. Mr. Sherwood Brewer was like a brother. He often said to me, after we finally set up the organization, he said, "You run the organization, and I'm going to watch your back because I play with and against them all." Mm-hmm. Mr. Brewer and I did so much to help the living player down through the years. We speak from 1996 when the organization was formed until this day. Mr. Brewer is no longer with us, but he didn't make me. I promised him that I would keep it. His legacy going for us. His motto was taking care of the living player that played in the Negro Baseball League. I have done that for 27 years, and I intend to continue on, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm 88 years old now. I don't know how long I'll be able to go, but I'm going to go as far as I can.
Speaking to you today... And hearing your stories about what life was like in the Negro Leagues was truly fascinating. And on behalf of myself and Saber, I would like to once again thank you for sitting down with me today and sharing these stories with me.